From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, The Sons of the Duke of Deception, we feature back-to-back interviews with Tobias Wolff and Jeffrey Wolff, two brothers who have each written memoirs about their family. Their father was a con man who convinced people he was an aristocrat. Tobias and Jeffrey grew up separately after their parents divorced. Jeffrey stayed with his father and learned how to be a gentleman. Tobias lived with his mother, who was broke and got into relationships with abusive men. Jeffrey's memoir is The Duke of Deception. Tobias's is This Boy's Life. And TV critic David Bianculli looks ahead to Tom Snyder's move from CNBC to CBS. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring back-to-back interviews with two writers who are brothers, Tobias Wolff and Jeffrey Wolff. Their memoirs are fascinating to read back-to-back. Jeffrey's memoir, The Duke of Deception, was about his father, a con man who fooled even his own children into believing he was from an aristocratic background. When Jeffrey and Tobias were children, their parents split up. Jeffrey lived with his father, Tobias with his mother. While Jeffrey was learning genteel manners, how to shoot and handle a boat, Tobias and his mother were virtually broke. Jeffrey's memoir is about discovering his father was a fraud. Tobias's memoir, This Boy's Life, is about traveling with a loving mother who wanted to make a new life but kept getting involved with abusive men. This Boy's Life was made into a movie starring Robert De Niro and Ellen Barkin. Tobias Wolff's new memoir, In Pharaoh's Army, was one of this year's National Book Award finalists. When I first spoke with Tobias Wolff in 1989, we began with a reading from the opening of his memoir, This Boy's Life, which had just been published.
Our car boiled over again just after my mother and I crossed the Continental Divide. While we were waiting for it to cool, we heard, from somewhere above us, the bawling of an air horn. The sound got louder, and then a big truck came around the corner and shot past us into the next curve, its trailer shimmying wildly. We stared after it. "Oh, Toby," my mother said. "He's lost his brakes." The sound of the horn grew distant, then faded in the wind that sighed in the trees all around us. By the time we got there, quite a few people were standing along the cliff where the truck went over. It had smashed through the guardrails and fallen hundreds of feet through empty space to the river below, where it lay on its back among the boulders. It looked pitifully small. A stream of thick black smoke rose from the cab, feathering out in the wind. My mother asked whether anyone had gone to report the accident. Someone had. We stood with the others at the cliff's edge. Nobody spoke. My mother put her arm around my shoulder. For the rest of the day, she kept looking over at me, touching me, brushing back my hair. I saw that the time was right to make a play for souvenirs. I knew she had no money for them, and I had tried not to ask, but now that her guard was down, I couldn't help myself. When we pulled out of Grand Junction, I owned a beaded Indian belt, beaded moccasins, and a bronze horse with a removable, tooled leather saddle. It was 1955, and we were driving from Florida to Utah to get away from a man my mother was afraid of and to get rich on uranium. We were going to change our luck.
One of the things I really like about that beginning is the sense of disaster can happen in any second. A trunk could just lose its brakes and go over the cliff. And your mother's going to try to be a good mother, and you're going to be a kid. I mean, it's just out of control. You're a kid. You're going to manipulate her to get that souvenir.
That's right. Yeah. It's an emblem of the book, in a way, that episode. We still talk about that episode. It made such an indelible impression on us. But
why? Why did it?
Well, we were so full of hope and going to this new life, and just for a moment there, we were too foolish for our optimism ever to get dampened for long, but just for a moment there, we tasted it, you know. We tasted our mortality, and we tasted the vanity of our hopes, seeing this man who probably was very hopeful himself about getting home for dinner that night, finishing his run, suddenly have everything go wrong on him. And I've never forgotten it. I can still see his face in the windshield.
You talked about how this memoir for you is really about coming of age, finding out who you are, who you want to be, and trying to become that. Your father transformed himself through lying, through making up a false history, through making up lineage that he didn't have, through even lying about his furniture and where that came from, making things into antiques that weren't.
Right.
Your mother wanted to transform herself and wanted to change her luck, but the way she ended up actually taking action was to hook up with different men.
Yes.
And all of those men ended up being disasters. They abused both your mother and you. And she seemed to really be unaware that that was going to happen each time she'd meet a new man. But you seemed to always know.
No, I didn't always know this was going to happen until it happened. I in a sense conspired in this by not learning my lesson either. We went from one man like this to another. It's true, but I think that what's more important than this is what we made of these situations. I mean, it's true that we drifted into these rather violent and frightening situations sometimes together, but we always kept faith with each other, and we kept our pluck, and we changed our luck again and again. We reinvented the circumstances. We'd go somewhere else and try again, and eventually, oddly enough, we were right. It worked. We both translated ourselves to different people and to better lives.
When you were young and you were in the Boy Scouts, you'd like to really read the Boy Scouts magazine, Boy's Life.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that really appeal to you? Your life was very different from the kind of mainstream view of what a Boy Scout should be, the good and healthy, wholesome life.
Yeah, that's right. I think that when I was reading it, I fell into a kind of spell in which I believed I was those boys that the magazine was about, these boys who saved lives and had trap lines in the Arctic, and boys who built airplanes in their backyards and flew them at state fairs, these extraordinary young entrepreneurs. And while I was reading this magazine, I felt like I was participating in this ideal American boyhood that all the movies I went to and the television shows and the radio shows that I listened to sort of invited us all to believe we were living. Yeah, so that magazine was very, very important to me in that way when I was young. That's why I called this memoir of mine, This Boy's Life. It's to distinguish between that ideal boyhood of the, you know, of Norman Rockwell, the kind of pictures that Norman Rockwell would draw of young, of childhood, and the kind that I and in fact most of the boys I knew when I was growing up actually lived.
You really wanted to have a conventional life and a conventional family.
Sure. Sure. I think it's a real cycle. I think that children who grow up in safe, secure, conventional, middle-class families all want to become outlaws and
right.
rebels and live in dirty apartments and never do the dishes. And children who grow up chaotically and in poverty and who have no automatic hold on respectability in the world come to prize conventionality and security. Yes, that's what I wanted when I don't want it so much anymore, I think, but I sure did want it when I was a boy.
Your mother wanted a good family that spent time together also, and I really like what you write about that. You say, Mother insisted we spend time together like a real family. Our failure was ordained because the real family we set out to imitate doesn't exist in nature. A real family as troubled as ours would never dream of spending time together.
That's right. Yeah, I'd forgotten that line. That's right.
But how much of that charade did you go through?
Well, we had our rich. This was the life I led with my first stepfather and his family, and that we led with them. And we did. We had these rituals of family life, and they were they gave us for a little while the appearance, and we actually probably believed that we were a real family when we would sit together and watch Lawrence Welk. I can't think hear the name today without wilting. Mitch something in the sing-along
Mitch
gang.
Mitch Miller.
He used to make us watch Mitch Miller. We'd all sit around. That was our idea of a family evening, is sitting in front of the tube and watching Lawrence Welk and Mitch Miller. And he, my stepfather would get his old saxophone out and sit there oh, Lord, don't make me relive it again.
I don't know. You've just been through it in your book, although you left out that particular story.
The Mitch Miller one I left out, but I've got Lawrence Welk in there all right.
Tobias Wolff is my guest, and his new memoir is called This Boy's Life. There's a scene that you describe, one of the father figures in your life, one of the men that your mother had hooked up with for a while, gave you a Winchester, a rifle, and one day you were leaning out the window, aiming the rifle out the window, pointing at a couple who were walking by, and you pulled the trigger and actually didn't shoot the couple, you shot a squirrel. But in describing that scene, in reading that scene, I couldn't help but wonder whether, looking back, you think you were ever on the verge of really becoming one of those neighbors next door who goes nuts and kills somebody?
Well, in a way, I guess the point of that scene is that anybody can become someone like that almost inadvertently. It's funny. My friends, when they've read that section, the men, not the women, have almost all said to me, incidentally, I was not aiming the rifle at these people when I pulled the trigger. I was aiming at something else. But it is true that I used to aim the rifle out the window at people walking past. And every boy I know who grew up in a house where there were weapons did things like that. They've all told me that. It is a very typical thing. What do you think kids do with those things? They watch, the things we watch in the movies and TV kind of take away our sense of mortality, that things don't have consequences when you point guns at people. You'll see them next week on another show. And we have an infatuation in this country with firearms and handling them. And boys left alone in a house, I think girls are not so interested in them, but boys left alone in a house with a weapon are going to get that weapon out and they're going to point it.
Your memoir, This Boy's Life, is about how you invented and reinvented yourself. And perhaps the most stunning reinvention of yourself that you're responsible for is how you got into prep school. Just to explain here, although your father had for a while been rich, your mother, who you were with, was always poor. And when you were in, I guess it was junior high school, you and your brother started communicating. And your brother urged you to try to get away from your father, your stepfather, who was beating you, and try to get into prep school. And he said he'd try to help you. So you got really hooked on the idea and tried to get a scholarship. So what you did was you made up letters of recommendations from all of your teachers. And you tried to really write it in their tone of voice. And you wrote, "And on the boy who lived in their letters, the splendid phantom who carried all my hopes, it seemed to me at last I saw my own face." And I thought that's so convincing that you were really, truly writing letters about the boy who you think you were or deserved to be as a boy, as opposed to the boy who you were forced to become.
Right. Yeah. Well, we all have a kind of dream self. Mm-hmm. And in writing those, my actual self, I'm afraid, wasn't quite the boy that I portrayed in those letters. I was a very indifferent student in a very bad school, and lazy, and I didn't even go to school a lot of the time. I hung out with a bad bunch, and I mean, they were actually good guys, really looking back on it, but they were considered a bad bunch then, and I was no model of American boyhood, and I had to get a scholarship to this prep school, and it was quite clear to me that being the boy I was, in fact, was not going to get me in. I couldn't even get a letter of recommendation from my teachers, so I decided to take this task on myself. What did I have to lose, right? I'd end up, if I lost, being where I was. So I basically wrote down in these letters of recommendation that I made up a picture of the boy that I dreamed I really was if everybody just knew me actually as well as I knew myself. And the straight A student, the Eagle Scout, upright fellow, and manufactured this identity and did it, I guess, persuasively enough, since I did get a scholarship to a fine prep school, which changed my life completely.
Did you do a convincing job of reinventing yourself at prep school because you had to pretend to be the boy who you had described in these letters, the boy who got you into this school?
No, it didn't hold up very well. For one thing, I coming from such a lousy school as I was coming from, and not having been a good student at that school anyway, I didn't know very much. I was very ignorant, and my teachers were puzzled at how little I knew, considering the brilliant transcripts that came in. I had a friend in the school office at that school who gave me the school transcript form, so I made out my own grades, and I awarded myself straight A's and in courses that I hadn't even taken in order to get in. So I didn't know very much. I had a terrible time academically at the school, but an English teacher there took me under his wing and tutored me and gave me books, and I was excited about reading anyway, but he taught me to be a systematic and careful reader, and he excited me about writing, as indeed my brother had also, and really brought me along. It was the pivotal experience of my life being at that school and being under that man's tutelage. And I owe, you know, just all kinds of things to him for that. So it turned out to be a wonderful, almost fairy tale escape for me, and I loved the school. But no, the act didn't hold up, and eventually it fell apart, and I was, in my senior year there, in my last year, my sixth form year, I was asked to leave.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Tobias Wolff, which was recorded just after the publication of his memoir, This Boy's Life. We'll hear more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Tobias Wolff, we were just talking about how you lied your way into prep school, but eventually got thrown out. Do you believe in lying when it's the only way to get what you need, and when you know that ultimately you're not telling a terrible mistruth, that it won't be a malicious mistruth?
Well, on the one hand, as a writer, I'm committed to truth. I mean, in this book about a boy who lies, I am very scrupulous in telling the truth, and the book is in a lot of ways about the cost of not telling the truth. So no, ultimately I think lies subtract from your substance as a person, and the more of them you tell, the more you beggar yourself. But I will distinguish between lying and invention, and especially self-invention. Children need to try on different selves. They don't know who they are. They try different things. You'll see the way kids change their hair constantly, you know, their hairdos, and experiment with their clothes and all that. It's really all sort of fumbling around trying to figure out who they are. And so there's a period when you're young when I think especially parents have to be very careful not to apply standards about lying to what is naturally occurring in the child's life in terms of just figuring out who they are and trying on different selves. And sometimes that involves acts of self-invention. And I think that, you know, that we have to be very tolerant about that.
Even when you're trying very hard to tell the truth, there are so many different versions of the truth. Did you run into that when writing this memoir? I think you gave the manuscript to your mother and to your brother and to others to read before
it
was published.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wanted to be sure that when it came out, they wouldn't say, oh, no, this is, not to others, but to me, you've got it all wrong. And I was very gratified that they were very impressed by the accuracy of the record and that it really squared with their own recollections. My mother had some questions about chronology. She has a wonderful kind of memory, and she says, here and there, I got things switched around and whatnot, but nothing serious at all. And basically, I let those things stand because that's the way I remembered them, and that's the story I'm telling, is what my memory tells me. You can follow someone around with a camera and a notebook and a tape recorder, and you'll get a lot of facts, but you won't get the truth. The truth lies in the memory, and because that's the story you tell yourself about who you are and where you come from, where you've been. And so I was very attentive to my memory and trusted that.
You and your brother have both written memoirs about your childhood. You've read each other's books, and you've become very close over the years, even though you were separated from each other during childhood.
Maybe that's why we're close.
Did you ever go through a period of envying each other's lives? Did you ever wish you'd stayed with your father? Did your father ever wish he'd stayed with your mother? Did he ever wish he was poor, like you were often poor? Did you ever wish that you had money like he did?
I can't speak for him. I don't think that he ever wished to be poor. I don't think anybody ever wished to be poor. But I certainly spent a lot of time wishing I was rich. And my father was a very charismatic guy. Though I hardly knew him, I remembered him well. I could remember the sort of tobacco smell that used to cling to his tweeds. He had a deep, grumbling voice, and he was big and had a very bearish kind of presence. And I remember lying in my bed at night and hearing his voice come through the bedroom wall, that rumble of his, and I'd feel how secure I'd feel hearing that. So there were, I longed to be with my father, not to be with my mother, but to be with my father also. And I romanticized him and idealized him.
We were talking about lies before. What was the most damaging lie that your father told you?
It wasn't so much lies he told me, but truths that he did not tell me. I was led to believe by him that we came from an aristocratic family, and that, he had coats of arms and all this, and my mother was Irish Catholic. I was brought up in the Catholic Church, and he objected to this. He said his family had always been Episcopalians and everything. Well, it turned out my father's family were a wonderful Jewish family of doctors and brilliant surgeons with their own claim to respect and stature, which he and some... he didn't want to be Jewish, and he cut my brother and I off not only from that knowledge, but from the knowledge of that of his wonderful family, because he didn't want us to understand this about him, and consequently about ourselves. And so we lost that half of our family. When my brother went back to write about my father and interviewed these people, they were wonderful people. And it broke our hearts that we had been denied their company when we were growing up, and the richness of that life that they had in Hartford. So, his lies had terrible, terrible consequences on us, as his absence did on me. That's partly what this book is about. I don't romanticize lying in this book. I talk about self-invention. I talk about lies, and the lies, The big lies in this book cause inestimable harm.
This is, I believe, the first really autobiographical thing that you've written. You've written stories about other people, and they are indirectly autobiographical. But this is direct autobiography.
Yes,
Do you feel exposed by it? What's the experience been for you?
Yes, I do. In the past, when people are, as I say, the way we're talking right now, if I'm being interviewed about a collection of stories or a novel that I've written, people will talk about the characters, and it's quite clear these are characters, these are inventions, even though obviously they may spring from some origin in my life. We're talking about figures in a book. And now when we're talking about this book, clearly we're talking about me, or at least my idea of who I am and the people I've known. And yes, I do feel vulnerable. I think I'd be crazy if I didn't.
One last thing. Do you think that your writing changed at all, that the voice you used was different because you were writing in first person?
Yes. Yes, it was, dear. It's a little fuller. I tend to have a little... It's, I think it's a warmer voice. It tends to be... I tended to really pull out the stops when I wrote this. I just imagined talking to a great friend, when I was writing this book, and let it rip.
Tobias Wolff, recorded in 1989 after the publication of his memoir, This Boy's Life. He has a new memoir about his tour of duty in Vietnam called In Pharaoh's Army. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, an interview with Tobias's brother, Jeffrey Wolff, in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, growing up with the Duke of Deception. We talk with writer Jeffrey Wolfe about his father, a con man who pretended to be from an aristocratic family and schooled Jeffrey in how to be a gentleman. Jeffrey Wolfe is the brother of Tobias Wolfe, who has also written about their family. And Tom Snyder is moving to CBS to host The Late Late Show after David Letterman. TV critic David Bianculli has some thoughts about the move and about Snyder's replacement on CNBC. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring interviews with two writers who are brothers and have each written memoirs about their family. Jeffrey Wolfe and Tobias Wolfe grew up separately after their parents divorced. Tobias, who we heard from earlier, went with their mother. Jeffrey stayed with their father. Jeffrey thought his father was a Yale-educated man of refinement. But he later learned his father was really a con man who made up his credentials and his lineage. Jeffrey's memoir about his father, The Duke of Deception, was republished earlier this year. I spoke with him in 1990, and he told me about the man his father pretended to be.
My father represented himself as a very well-educated man, and I mean so well-educated that he represented himself as having a degree in aeronautical engineering from the Sorbonne, which is, of course, a school of the humanities, has no aeronautical engineering degree anyway. His ambition in the beginning, I believe, was to impress his father, who was a surgeon and very hard to impress. And then he tried to impress others. And the process of trying to impress others was always self-aggrandizement. He claimed to have been a war hero, for example, in ways that were awfully hard to reconcile, because he claimed to have parachuted in among the Yugoslav partisans at about the same time he was flying with the Flying Tigers over Burma. His process always was engorgement. I mean, he had huge appetites, and he was a person who said, just a little bit too much is just enough for me, for example. He was, I suppose, what you'd call clinically a psychopath, in the sense that he seemed to have no moral conscience. He'd write bad checks in a restaurant, but he always tipped in cash. He knew how to take care of the help. He was immensely charming. He was witty. He was well-read. He was very quick. He was very smart. He was very warm. He was a crook, and he spent the last years of his life in prison.
But when you were growing up, you didn't know any of this.
No. When I was growing up, he was a hero, and I idolized him, and I idolized him probably for the right reasons. I idolized him because of his warmth and his wit and his unfailing attention to me. He was a very loving man. He had many friends. And so the particulars of his curriculum vitae were all unknown to me, and at that time of no interest to me. So in an odd way, I could say that I had a happy childhood, except when he was away, which was a lot of the time.
How did the masks get taken off?
Well, a lot of them get taken off when a son or a friend begins to become acute enough to see that things aren't matching up, that they don't make any sense. He got caught. Well, he rose to the to the august position of assistant chief engineer at Boeing. At the time, they were building the XB-52. And because he had to have atomic clearance for that, it was after the war, it was, I think, 1949, 1950, he got caught by the FBI. And the FBI traced back all his job resumes. And job resumes were okay. They tracked back. He'd worked for North America and he'd worked for Northrop. But all of a sudden, they tracked him back to the Sorbonne, that all of that monkey shines with the Sorbonne and the Yale and Groton. And he hadn't even been born where he said he was born. He liked the idea of having been born in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York. So at about the year 1937, which was a rather potent year, he fell off the face of the earth to the FBI. And I'm here to tell you, they were very upset by that.
So did you learn about this through the FBI?
I learned some of it when the FBI came to visit our house in Seattle. And I remember how nice they were. I mean, how kind and gentle they were, the FBI agents. In fact, they told me that they'd like me to leave the room, and they were extremely polite, courteous to my father. And when they left, for the first time I saw him deeply shaken. But at the same time, you know, by then, the circumstances of our life had been so erratic. We'd lived high life and low. We'd lived in horrible rooming houses and in antebellum mansions. We had lived off the cuff. We had lived in the Ritz-Carlton, and we'd lived in a cold water walk up in Niagara Falls. We'd lived all over the place. So by the time this happened, and I was 14 years old, I didn't know what to expect anymore, ever. And that seemed all natural to me, because we take the extraordinary in our lives almost for granted in an odd way. I think all children do that.
Did you ever talk to your father and confront him with the truth of his identity?
I did it twice in particular. The first time, I will never forget. I'd grown up with the last name that I have, Wolf, and as it happens, my father's father was a Jew, and my father's mother was a Jew. As it happens, my father's father was a Jewish atheist. My father represented himself as an Episcopalian and absolutely denied his Jewishness. So he absolutely denied mine as well. And at a time when I was at the Choate School, I'd spent some time looking in the mirror. And I said, boy, that certainly looks like a Jewish boy to me that I'm looking in the mirror at. And I remember asking my father for about the third time, I said, am I Jewish? And I remember him becoming extremely exasperated. In a very calculated and in a very effective manner. And he said, for God's sake, he said, you know me. Am I an anti-Semite? And I said, no, you're not an anti-Semite. And he said, then why in the world would I lie about being a Jew? Why in the world would I lie about such a thing? And at that moment, my choices were binary. I either had to disbelieve him about everything that I knew, or I had to believe him. And it was a horrible and unforgivable thing that he did to me that day. And of course, I won't forget it. The other time I confronted him is by writing a novel called Bad Debts, in which I wrote what turned out to be a cartoon version of him, a kind of a caricature version of a con man. And I sent him that book shortly before he died. At the same time, he was stone broke. He'd just gotten out of prison. He had some Social Security. And he was getting checks from me every month. And after he read that book, Bad Debts, he stopped cashing the checks, which is the most extraordinary thing of all the extraordinary things I know about him.
We're featuring a 1990 interview with Jeffrey Wolfe. His memoir about his father is called The Duke of Deception. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Hi,
back with writer Jeffrey Wolfe.
Let's bring up the subject of your brother, Tobias Wolfe, who's also a writer now. And when your parents separated, he went with his mother, you went with your father. And as you were growing up, sometimes living the high life, sometimes living the low life, he was growing up in a near broke atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to come east where you were living to get away from his mother's abusive lover. He wanted to go to a boarding school and was hoping that you would help to get him in. And you did. I was wondering if you ever gave him advice on how to behave in a more middle class kind of environment, the kind of environment he was about to enter.
Oh, poor baby, did I give him advice? Oh, did I give him advice? I gave him advice till it came out his ears. And that advice now, I mean, he and I spend a lot of time laughing at that advice. I taught him manners, but I also, I remember we had this extraordinary summer together in La Jolla, California. My father had a nervous breakdown. He was in a mental hospital, in fact. And my brother and I hadn't seen each other for, I think it was almost 12 years, and it was just before he went to the Hill School, and I just graduated from Princeton. And he didn't have a job. He was a little kid. He was 15. And so I was supporting us at the time. And I remember every day before I went off to work, I'd make him read a book, a whole book, and write an essay about it. Every day. I mean, I had this absolute power over him, and I exercised it. But he wrote for that summer every single day an essay, and every single day he read one of the great books that I assigned to him. And it was a horrible abuse of power on my part, but at the same time, I don't regret it now for a moment, and I'm not sure he does either.
You know, I'm sure a lot of people see you and your brother almost as this peculiar science experiment. What happens if two brothers are separated, live in completely different kinds of environments, in different social and economic classes, and then meet as young adults, you know? And now you both ended up as writers. You both ended up writing memoirs about growing up and about growing up with your parents or with your parent. it's really kind of remarkable. And I wonder how much you think is genetic.
Well, I don't know how much is genetic. He finds it less remarkable than I do. As a matter of fact, we had a conversation about this issue this morning. We talk almost, I suppose we talk 3 or 4 times a week, and we spend most of our time laughing. But we were talking about this very question: how remarkable is it that we both write? And he finds it utterly unremarkable. He said, "It's as unremarkable as saying two people have blonde hair, for example." I find it remarkable. So here we divide on it. Because he can't imagine, as I can't imagine, doing anything other than what we do, he can't find anything remarkable in it, I think.
What surprised you most when you read your brother's memoir about growing up, this boy's life?
I'd always known he was smart. I didn't know that he was a genius. It's an extraordinary book. In an odd way, I found myself reading his book and forgetting he was my brother. He became a character apart from me. I mean, a character with absolute integrity. Part of it, of course, was extremely sad. Part of it was scarifying to me to see how unhappy he had been at times. But after I'd finished the book, I realized that what he had done in his book was a thing I'd tried to do in my book too, was he had brought back alive and intact the whole complexity of what we call an unhappy childhood, that it isn't just monolithically unhappy, that it's complicated, very complicated, that there are parts of it that aren't unhappy at all. There are parts of it that are characterized by laughter and by singing and by friendships and by love and affection. And there isn't such a thing, or at least in my experience, and I think I can say in his, as a childhood that is simply unhappy.
Since you and your brother are pretty close now and you're both writers, Are there ever territorial concerns over who owns a certain story that you share?
I think there have been in the past. That's ancient history, and it's also comic history. That's the kind of thing we wind up laughing about. There used to be a time, for example, when I'd call him and tell him a story, and I'd say, "You can't use this. This is mine." And sometimes he'd do the same thing. We don't do that anymore because we don't have to. Also, we don't tell stories like that anymore in print. In other words, the neat anecdote, the joke, or something doesn't find itself into print quite as frequently as it used to in the bad old days with us. But the subject of who owns what now is a subject of high comedy, or I should say, low comedy for us.
Do you feel that you're very good now at telling who lies, at spotting someone who is a con themselves?
Sure. But I used to be obsessed with lying. I used to be obsessed with lying and the truth, and I don't care about it so much anymore. I have two sons, and when they were first growing up, I used to tell them horribly. It's sort of enjoin them always to tell me the truth, son, never lie to me. Quite solemn about it. And of course they didn't. I mean, they lie the way all kids do about all kinds of things that they don't think I should know, and they're absolutely right, I shouldn't know them. And so I've got a good laissez-faire attitude toward the whole thing now. But can I spot a phony? I think yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and about writing. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Geoffrey Wolfe recorded in 1990. A new edition of his memoir, The Duke of Deception, was published this year. His next book, Age of Conquest, will be published in February. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have from Bosnia?
Hi, Terry. Andy Bowers reports on developments today at the NATO meeting in Brussels. There's a new diplomatic initiative underway, yet again, to try to get the Bosnian Serbs to talk about peace. I'll talk with Tom Jelton in Sarajevo. There was a rocket attack on a government building in downtown Sarajevo at the same time a UN special envoy was visiting there. Michael Scholar reports from the refugee camp in Goma, Zaire. It's now being controlled, he says, by members of the former Hutu government in Rwanda. Elizabeth Arnold reports on the new Senate leadership. Tom Daschle will be the minority leader. And I'll talk with the actor Jodie Foster about her new film. It's called Nell.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Last night, Tom Snyder made his farewell appearance as host of his own talk show on CNBC. Beginning in January, the former host of Tomorrow on NBC is back on network TV as host of The Late Late Show following David Letterman on CBS. Our TV critic David Bianculli likes Snyder, likes the move to CBS, and also likes Snyder's replacement on CNBC.
There are lots of people who think Snyder is too old to host a show like this now, but I've got news for them. He was too old then, back during his glory days on Tomorrow. But he attracted and held young audiences in the 70s for the same reason he will in the 90s. Tom Snyder is what live TV is all about. It's not that he's the best interviewer around, although he's a lot better prepared than, say, Larry King. He's not the handsomest, or the hippest, or the funniest. But Letterman is a big fan of Snyder's for the same reason I am. When the guy sits there, without a studio audience, leaning into the TV camera and talking off the top of his head, he's the most unaffected, unpredictable, totally human guy on TV. In older days of TV, lots of guys knew how to do this and do it well. Arthur Godfrey, Jack Parr, even Ernie Kovacs. But in the 90s, with Snyder's intimate way of talking and his intentionally antiquated TV vocabulary, he calls his CNBC show the Color Cast. Snyder stands alone. In a scripted and manic TV world, he's laid back and liable to go anywhere.
Good evening, folks, and welcome back, everybody. I'm T.S. This is the Color Cast, up and running now for Tuesday night. It is the 29th of November, 1994. Beware tonight, folks. I've just come from a major cable cocktail party. Oh, they're going crazy across the street tonight. All the cable ops are in town. They went to see the Jay Leno Tonight Show, and now we're liquoring them up. We're oiling the wheels for the big sales pitch that comes at 8:30 at the restaurant down the road. We'll sell this sucker if it kills us, okay? Joining us tonight is...
In a month, The Late Late Show with Tom Snyder will show up on CBS, and a new generation of network viewers will get a taste of what he's been quietly doing on radio and cable since Letterman, of all people, replaced him in the 80s. Meanwhile, replacing Snyder on CNBC is another talented guy, Charles Grodin. I know. I asked the same question. Why Charles Grodin? But Grodin has guest hosted for Snyder before and written a couple of books that demonstrate his unusual perspective on show business. He's not the kind of host you'd expect, which is precisely what might make him a good host. Grodin has such a dry sense of humor, he can be sarcastic or even downright dishonest while maintaining a straight face, as he did earlier this month when he appeared as a guest on Snyder's show the night the announcement was made.
As a matter of fact, you know, since my problem, I think, is going to be likability, and you're so incredibly likable, could you help me with something? Would you just, like, do something likable? Just do one of your likable things.
I'd rather ask you a question that you would respond to.
See, that's likable right there. You don't want to put the focus on yourself. You want to ask me something.
I do, because many people have asked me this when the announcement was made, and there was stuff in the papers out here, Variety, last week, and that is, why would Charles Grodin, who is an established motion picture actor and star, who has had a very successful career making big pictures that people like to go and see, who is an accomplished author of several books that have been bestsellers or near bestsellers, why would Chuck Grodin want to involve himself with a cable television show four or five nights a week? And so I ask you that question. Okay. Why do you want to do this?
Well, you know, I'm so sorry that all these questions are seeming to lead in a similar direction, but they're paying me an enormous amount of money to do this. I mean, I'm probably... money like you probably... I mean, it's really the money, Tom. It's the money.
If you don't think either of these guys will be big success stories in 1995, just watch. I know I will.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.